Good afternoon. Lovely to see you here at the 15th annual Boston Book Festival. I'm Debbie Porter. I'm the founder of the festival. How many people here don't think that Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have too much power? No one. Okay. Maybe today we'll find out what we're going to do about that. I want to thank GBH. They are our presenting partner this year. Very grateful to have them, and I'm very grateful for our individual donors who help make all this possible free of charge. You too can become a donor, as you saw up there. You can go to our tent and get some great swag. And we would really appreciate that. We love doing this every year, and we love that you guys help us to do that. Now, please join me in welcoming our esteemed panel and our host, Meghna Chakrabarty, who is the host of On Point on WBUR. Thank you.
Can you guys hear me? You can. Okay. So I oftentimes, Boston Book Fest is kind enough to give me a choice on the panels that I might be privileged to host, and this was the one I chose by far, because I think, and obviously you and our panelists think, that AI is one of the most significant, I would say, civilizational changes that we will all, are all, and will all be living through. So I wanted to say that in terms of how much I care about this topic, and then just quickly introduce everyone. Let me start here with, this is Jonathan Taplin. His book is The End of Reality, How Four Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. Mm. Brian Merchant, Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech, and Coco Crummy, there in the end. Optimal Illusions, The False Promise of Optimization. Now, before I actually started with the three of you, I thought I would do a very unscientific survey of the audience. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask a bunch of questions about whether or not you think AI is already in use in certain fields. Okay, I'm kind of going back and forth about whether you should participate. Okay, well, I'll ask the audience first, and then you raise your hands. Okay, so if the answer to the following question is yes, raise your hand. But I'm going to give you the fields. If it's no, obviously don't raise your hand. Okay. Now, looking at the audience, I'm thinking these are going to be too easy. But medical diagnosis. Okay, that was too easy, and obviously, yeah, right? Everyone's saying yes.
Yes.
Lifespan prediction. Maybe I should turn around. Does anyone think it's not, AI is not in use in that? No, okay. Grade school exams and standardized testing. Okay. Mortgage lending. These are all too easy. Three forms of policing. Where to dispatch police? Any no's? Suspect identification. Predictive or preventative policing. All right, everyone obviously is right on that. How about this one? Professional sports. Everybody, are there no's? Any no's for professional sports? I think the answer is I couldn't find one where AI wasn't in use. Sports was the most interesting one to me because I didn't know that much about it. But right now, the NFL uses AI to analyze game films to improve player performance. That used to be a thing that coaches did, I think. Major League Baseball, obviously a statistics-obsessed sport. They're using AI to help teams make better decisions on who to field. And the NBA on improving its scouting process. And interestingly, there by some predictions, by 2030, AI could be a $20 billion business in those three leagues alone. So the point being that it's everywhere, right?
It's everywhere, yeah.
So I'd love to start if each of you could actually give us a 1 to 2 sentence of how you define AI. Because, you know, we in the media and in common parlance, I think sometimes we say AI when we don't really mean it. So let me, John, start with you.
Okay, so I thought that Sam Altman's definition that the marginal cost of intelligence was going to drop to zero in the next 10 years. And he said that that would mean millions of people would be out of work and the transfer of wealth from labor to capital would be the greatest in the history of humankind, and that there would be no way to avoid a revolution without something like universal basic income.
Okay.
So I think essentially AI is the marginal cost of intelligence. In other words, the ability to use machines to make intelligent decisions.
Yeah, it's the thing that brings that marginal cost down to zero.
Yeah.
Brian?
Yeah, well, I guess on top of that, on a functional level, when we're talking about AI in 2023, we're usually talking about a large language model or a neural net and to do things like generate text, generate images. So we're usually thinking of like a large language model, and a way to think about the way that, you know, 90% of the AI systems that you'll encounter on a daily basis is really smart text prediction. It's thinking of the next word to plug into the sentence one by one by one. And I can already see that maybe we're gonna have some fun discussions today, because I would assert that AI is not always intelligent, and that there's a lot of critics who think that AI is a kind of a misnomer a lot of the times. It's sort of inflationary in terms of getting the public to sort of think that it can do all these things that maybe it can't. And the biggest reason that AI is used in a lot of those fields that we rattled through is because startups think that they can make money doing it right now more than anything. So I would define AI as a large language model, generative text or images systems, and a huge buzz trend that's sucking up a lot of investment and interest in Silicon Valley right now.
All right. Well, I'm going to refine even further. I think your challenge is going to be to find places where we actually disagree rather than are building on each other. So off of the two elements, the I absolutely agree there's a huge hype bubble right now around AI. You see this term, artificial intelligence, it's migrated a little bit, right? We used to call it machine learning. Before that, we called it data science. And it's attracted, you know, a huge amount of speculative funding for technologies that are interesting, dangerous, pervasive, but maybe in some ways not all that they're cracked up to be or feared. Mm-hmm. And then on a technical level, I would refine Brian's definition a little bit even further and say that it's computationally intensive, predictive statistics. So I think one thing that distinguishes our current notion of AI or the current technology from maybe the technologies that existed 40 or 50 years ago that actually statistically weren't that much less sophisticated than what we have today. The big difference is that now we have this ability to process these things in the cloud. You know, massive, massive computational power is being thrown at them, and that allows new kinds of predictions, new kinds of very scary infiltration into these new fields, and done at a speed and a pervasiveness that we haven't seen before.
If memory serves, I said 1 to 2 sentences, all three of you. I wonder if we had a large language model analyze your answers, if it would come up with the conclusion that AI is just very challenging to define in a few sentences, or that writers are delightfully unpithy most of the time, or maybe a combination of the two. But really, kind of like hand the stuff back and forth a little bit, because I want to hear a lot from all three of you. What interested me in your book is that while you're talking about these transformational technologies, all of your books are really focused on people, you know, as well. So again, just for the sake of brevity, so we can sort of bounce off each other's ideas. Actually, Coco, I'd like to start with you because, I mean, your book is about optimization, and you look at optimization in some really interesting ways. Like, I was fascinated to read how it factors into things like wildlife studies and what was the other one? Sugar beet farmers. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I'm taking kind of a deeper historical look at some of the underlying, and I'll try to keep it to maybe 10 sentences rather than 20. But I'm taking a deeper historical look into some of the intellectual strains that underlie optimization, this ruthless kind of quest for efficiency that we see behind a lot of today's technologies like AI. And, you know, the sugar beet example in particular is looking at American agriculture and in particular commodity agriculture and how over the last century it's been scaled up in incredible ways. We now have farms that are orders of magnitude, several orders of magnitude larger than a few generations ago. We have equipment that costs $500,000. We have crops traded on global markets. And it's very easy to go in this one direction of optimizing that. It's much harder to step back once we've acknowledged, you know, there are benefits, but there are also costs to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, Brian and John, you actually have really interesting sets of people in different historical periods, and almost they're almost like bookends to each other. So let's go back in time and talk about the industrial age, and specifically, just tell us a little bit about George Mellor.
Sure. Yeah. So George Mellor was a cloth worker at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, who, along with hundreds of thousands of other skilled workers, recognized that machinery was being used in a way that was going to, if not automate his job completely, then automate it to the point where children can do it or unskilled workers could do it. And it was those machines were being bought en masse by people who had a lot more money than him and a lot more power than him, and he joined what would become known as the Luddite uprising. He became one of the Luddites. Today we remember them as you know, people who smash machines. If you know what the Luddites are, then you probably think of the term as somebody who hates machines, doesn't get them, doesn't understand them, and wants to destroy them. That was not really the case. People like George understood technology quite well. They used it a lot. A lot of them were technologists, technicians themselves, and they simply realized the ways that it was going to be used against them to degrade their working conditions, to undermine their livelihoods, and to sort of start to shepherd working people into the factory. Basically, today, you know, the analogy would be we see AI and generative AI being used to do a lot of creative work, like that's typically done by copywriters, illustrators, you know, even coders, and these, you know, jobs we think of as skilled and require some kind of degree of training or apprenticeship, and now a large system can do them with a, you know, with a prompt or a few words plugged into a inputted into a system. So George was 200 years ago sort of watching all this happen, and the state back then was even more hands-off than ours is now, and was doing nothing to protect these jobs or to protect the livelihoods of what was the largest industrial base in England. So, you know, after about 10 years of cloth workers really trying to fight for better conditions and some protections against this stuff, and getting nothing from Parliament or the machine-owning class, they've formed this Luddite uprising. We can talk more about that in detail, but that is, needless to say, the kind of thing we would hope to prevent from happening today.
Yeah. That'll be something I want to talk to all of you about a little bit later, like, how can we do it better this time around? Now, John, so you wrote a book about Elon Musk, Mark Andreessen, Mark Zuckerberg, and Peter Thiel. I think we all sort of have some familiarity, if not a lot, with the businesses and technologies that those four are associated with, but you looked into their personal histories, which was really interesting. If there's, you know, is there something that's common to all four in their personal histories that can help us understand sort of their particular worldview views now?
They all had horrible childhoods. Elon Musk was thrown down three flights of stairs by his schoolmates. Peter Thiel was bullied completely until he found chess, that he was able to find something that he was good at. Mark Andreessen describes his childhood as being a hellscape and still hates his father virulently. And Mark Zuckerberg is a guy that if you saw David Fincher's The Social Network, you kind of have a sense of what he was. I mean, from my sense, they're all a menace to society. if you think about, you look at the chart of teenage self-harm, suicides, cutting, all that, it goes along, and then all of a sudden in 2011, it just goes through the roof. Well, that 2011 is when Mark Zuckerberg introduced the like button. And 2012, he brought us Instagram. So from the point of view of all these four people control social media, because, you know, Thiel and Andreessen were the earliest investors in Facebook, and obviously Elon controls X. And then you just look at what's happened in the last week on X. It is a cesspool of anti-Semitic stuff. And 3 weeks ago, he called out the Anti-Defamation League for having said to advertisers, this is a Nazi, neo-Nazi cesspool, and it's like shooting the messenger, you know? I mean, Elon took over the program, got rid of all the content moderators, invited all the neo-Nazis like Kanye West back on the platform, and then the ADL has the temerity to point out to advertisers what's going on. And Elon thinks that's wrong, that they're trying to ruin his business. So the problem for me is there's two views of the world. Either we use the collective intelligence, scientific knowledge, technology to fix the things on the planet that we know how to do, or we take the view that they do, which is in 10, 15 years, AI and the robots will do most of the work, 40 to 50% of the population will be out of work. And of course, then the metaverse makes sense, because if you're sitting at home for 7 hours a day because you got nothing to do, maybe you want to be in a fantasy universe with a helmet on for 7 hours a day and pretend you're Tony Stark and date Gwyneth Paltrow's avatar and, you know, go live a fantasy life. But they're all into, what I'm trying to show is they're all into fantasy. Elon wants us to give him $10 trillion to go to Mars, where there's no oxygen. I mean, what an idiotic plan.
That is not an idiotic plan. I will stand up in defense of space exploration.
That plan to spend $10 trillion to go to Mars is a stupid plan.
Well, we know that's
people,
not, we know
that's
not
JPL,
going to happen.
The
but
people
you,
at
your
JPL
criticism was that Mars
me,
has no oxygen, so therefore it's a stupid plan.
No,
so.
No, we're on Mars right now. We have three rovers on Mars. They don't need oxygen, they don't burn up with the radiation, and they do all the same things humans could do. The guys at JPL told me, well, Elon's just using the old thing, no Buck Rogers, no bucks, which is that Congress won't give you money unless you send some daring human up on this mission.
That happens to be
whereas
true.
You can actually send robots and probes and space probes up there and do all the work without spending $10 trillion, $2 trillion of which will go into Elon's pocket.
Yeah. So what I want to do, actually, I would be delighted to debate you on the okay. merits or lack thereof of space exploration at any time, John. But so I want you guys to sort of bounce off of each other a sure. little bit. And here's why. And please do feel free to tell me if I'm mistaken here. But as I read all of your books, obviously there seemed to be, in my eyes, very strong connections between the three, and also strong connections between your analysis of where we are now versus where we were in the past. You know, for example, you know, in Coco, in your book, it seemed really interesting that you looked to some of the founding principles of America as a way to understand the yearn towards optimization. And then obviously, Brian, your book is very much rooted in history and the last great technological revolution and the upheavals, which actually was that it caused, which was roughly in the same time period. Yeah. And John, I was really interested about how you might think of those two observations, because what actually, one of the things that connects them all, in my opinion, is capitalism, that it wasn't just the technology, it was the political and economic situations, which we have now, that allows for the rapid development of technology and the contemporaneous explosive development of wealth amongst a very few, right? So with those connections in mind, just talk to each other, sure. Really, for a minute or
so
two.
So I was fascinated by Coco's notions of optimization and efficiency. Because I think, you know, one of the things one of my characters, Mark Andreessen, says is AI will make the entertainment business much more efficient. And the entertainment business, or art in general, has never had efficiency as the main principle. You can go down to the Bob Dylan Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you can see, because I work for Bob Dylan, you can see 10 drafts of Like a Rolling Stone. It took him 3 months to write the song. It was not efficient. That's not the thing. And so this notion that efficiency, and look, this is what this Hollywood strike was all about. The studios wanted to be able to put all the screenplays they own into a large learning model, and then write a 4-paragraph prompt that would take a half hour, and the thing would spit out a first draft in 2 hours. Usually it is a process that costs $750,000 and 9 months.
Yeah.
So maybe it's efficient, but it's not going to be original. It's not going to be art. It's a false dream.
Coco, can you take me the uses of this AI and how efficiency is becoming the dominant paradigm in places well outside of sort of strict engineering or logistical practices is really interesting. But I am curious to hear you just say a little bit more, because it connects the history here, about why you look to America's founding principles as a place to understand how we are where we are with technology.
And I also had a thought on that and then wanted to connect it to Brian's book. But I do think part of my argument is that optimization and this drive towards efficiency, towards these kinds of technologies that inspire AI, is a very American thing. It's a very Western thing, right? You don't see this way of thinking in a lot of cultures outside of the modern West. And I think it's particularly and peculiarly American. And I do tie it back to sort of, you know, some of the like Protestant spirit, et cetera, capitalism, but also to this drive to understand and control and engineer. Boston is steeped in history. Our first European settlers on this continent saw it as a world for their control and for them to control, and a blank slate on which to create. And you look at, you know, how an optimization works in a technical way, it is all about bounding a box and then maximizing or finding the best within that. So it's a little bit of a sort of a literary metaphor, but I think that kind of cultural ethos still pervades today and very much inspired a lot of what goes on in Silicon Valley and what's now kind of extending out into the arts, into all these other fields.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question, though?
Please, go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, we were having a little chat before about the arts, and then I was curious after reading sort of the last part of Brian's book, where you talk about kind of a potential neo-Luddite revolution and whether, you know, that's going to happen or not. So I'm actually very curious what you all think of, are we ripe for that? How do we fight back against these forces that you identify?
I'll let Brian answer first.
Yeah. So you know, I did wanted to say real quickly on the tail of both what you both were saying that I think the story of technological development and, you know, who gets to do that and who carries it out most of the time, people with access to the resources and the question of whether, you know, we want to automate or to streamline various processes or streamline art. I mean, back 200 years ago in the Industrial Revolution, you know, these craftsmen took a lot of pride in, you know, in creating the cloth products, the garments, the stockings that they would make, and it was also kind of seen as an affront to all that skill, all that work that they had learned how to do, and so I think it's completely valid, and something that we don't do enough is to interrogate whether or not something should be optimized or made efficient, and I mean, that's a point raised in your book, and it's quite central to it, and it's something that we now have a very centralized industry, very powerful industry that is hell-bent on optimizing just about everything, and that is leading to a lot of problems, and it does kind of sync up quite neatly with what's happening with AI, where, you know, ChatGPT and DALL-E and the kind of the things that produce the text or the images, they get most of the headlines and the attention, but what these companies are really hoping to do is to sell enterprise-tier software to businesses all over the country so that they can automate, you know, smaller tasks within the organization or maybe remove a copywriting job here and there and to try to... It's really a business of promising efficiency. Part of what I show in my book is that it doesn't always work out that way. Usually it's a way to displace or degrade or erode wages rather than eliminate the job completely, and that's still today. You look at the supply chain of AI, and there's invisible workers making it possible all the way down from, you know, doing quality assurance of the output to training the systems to making sure it's not, you know, offering up horrible results. But it's getting us to this point where, yeah, I think there are a lot of people who are really concerned, and rightfully so, that their jobs may be disrupted or eroded, or their identities will be sort of undermined by these new technologies, whether or not the system can actually replace them. It's really important to know that, because most of the time it cannot. And most of the time it's being used by managers or bosses or as a way to exert leverage over a worker or to try to undercut wages. So if we understand that, then you can understand what the writers in the WGA, for example, understood, which is that we know this thing's not going to churn out the next Spielberg movie, no matter how many times you enter a prompt into it. But what we also know is that the studios would love to say, okay, we used AI to make an original script, now we're going to pay you a reduced fee to rewrite it, to doctor it up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then, so that's what their fight was about. So they drew this red line. I argue that they basically did Luddism, which was rejecting a specific use of exploitative technology. And they said, no. If we're going to be allowed to, if you want AI in the picture, then we want to have the say over how we use it in our art and how we do it. And they won that. They won that really important distinction. They won that control over the use of technology in their labor process.
Do you mind if I step in here? Because we only have about 10 minutes before we want to get some questions. No, you can go ahead, but I just want to, we only have about 10 minutes before we want to have an audience question.
What Coco is suggesting is there a resistance? And I believe there is a resistance movement. And I think the Writers Guild was maybe the first beginnings of that. But if you think about the fact that there's a company called Stable Diffusion that does image generative AI,
yeah.
They took 12 million copyrighted images from Getty without permission and put it into their model and to train their model. So I can ask it, give me a picture of Joni Mitchell in a Western saloon in 1865, and it will do it. But of course, how did it do it? Because there were 10,000 images of Joni Mitchell in this Getty corpus. They didn't ask permission. None of the photographers got anything. And this is going to be the big issue. Does Stephen King have the right to get paid when they're training the ChatGPT on his corpus of data? So you can say, write me a Stephen King novel, and it'll do it right now.
Yeah.
And this has got to be stopped. And there's lots of suits. I'm on the Authors Guild Council. We sued OpenAI last week to stop them from taking all these books into their data without permission.
Yeah.
Mm. And this is the whole move fast and break things philosophy these people live under. We'll just go and do it, and then we'll ask permission later.
Yeah.
And it's just wrong. And so, yes, there is resistance. And I see it everywhere. I see it in the food business. I see it in the art business. I see it in architecture everywhere.
Okay.
It really is.
Can I just jump in here? No. Because obviously this panel is, I have three very intelligent, thoughtful authors who are casting a much-needed critical eye in terms of, like, let's not repeat the mistakes of the past. I myself have actually done, we've done a lot of shows on AI, but I wanted to, again, query the audience and and you three as well. First of all, who right now does not have a cell phone or a smartphone with them? Who has never ordered anything from Amazon? Okay, we got a couple. Okay, who has never used Google? Who doesn't think electric vehicles are important for a climate neutral or a climate safe future? Okay, good. Who doesn't want their doctors to be able to give you much more accurate diagnosis on rare diseases and therefore have more time to focus on your health and well-being? You see where I'm going. I think we're all hypocrites. I absolutely think we're all hypocrites. And I say that including myself, because I spend a lot of time thinking about the profound negatives that are coming with this current technological revolution. But at the same time, when you ask people, nobody really, everybody wants, in a sense, not all, but some of the great benefits that are coming with AI, that have come with any major tech. I know, he's getting mad at me. You can, yeah. But what I'm saying is,
we gotta get some questions.
3:55, I promise you. What I'm saying is, it does us no good to only focus on the catastrophe scenarios. What I'd like to know is, because the technology is being developed and we will actually be benefiting from a great deal of it, how do we do it in a way that doesn't actually repeat the mistakes of the past?
Well, the problem is that Elon Musk will go to the White House and say, I want regulation. But he doesn't really mean it. And he will do everything. And if you look at the history of social media, the notion that the government could have some way to force content moderation has been floated since I wrote Move Fast and Break Things in 2015. So it's not going to happen. These people, you know, four companies will control AI. That's the way it is because it takes so much computing power. So I don't think regulation is actually going to happen as much as I think it would be good. And I think there's so many ethical issues, not just can they take all artists' work without permission, but if you think about transhumanism, which, you know, I write about a lot in my book, do you want to be able to make a smarter baby out of an in vitro thing because we can use CRISPR to edit the genes of the thing?
Yeah.
Do we want to? I mean, there's
so
many ethical issues.
I always think about, you know, what role regulation has to play, and hearing John say that regulation, the right kind of regulation, may not ever have a role here. That's difficult for me to accept because we, you know, like, we've got to live into this future that we have. I'll take you at your word for a second. Let's sort of move the government out of this. Are there things that we can do in other spheres? I mean, the Luddites still lost, but unions came thereafter, right?
Unions were, yeah, an outgrowth of Luddism. And first I'll say that, like, I don't think any of you are hypocrites if you use those tech products because the ends do not justify the means. We could have all of these technologies. They could be differently constituted. They could be developed in ways that are humane. They could be developed in ways that have more democratic inputs from the users and the people that they impact. You could have an Amazon that pays its workers fairly and doesn't watch as they pass out from heat exhaustion and then scoop them up and put them into private ambulance. Right. You could have a lot of buffers. You could you could encourage more organizing of the workplaces. You could have different modes of development other than pouring billions of dollars into a tiny sliver of Silicon Valley startup founders who do not represent the world at large, and then telling them to go out and design the systems that are going to be the foundations of digital life for the next 10 years. We have other alternatives that we can explore, and we should be pressing for more democratic inputs. I think regulation is the place to start, and more organizing. All of those are buffers that we can work on instituting now before we, you know, undertake.
Can I just follow up on the Amazon example? So I'm really into polling this audience today. Have all of you at least heard of some of the things that Brian was talking about regarding worker treatment? Did it stop anybody from ordering from Amazon after you heard about it? Okay, that's good. That's great. I am very glad to hear that. I don't have the number in front of me, but I'm not sure that Amazon's overall revenue went down. No.
No.
Okay.
No.
Except for the wonderful people in this audience who acted on their values. Thank you. I bring up this point because I completely agree with you. The effectiveness of consumer pressure.
It's not, yeah.
But we wish that it could be more.
Well,
but
it's not, NPR quit Twitter after Elon said that they were
But Twitter
ego.
Didn't care.
Okay.
It didn't make a bit of difference to Twitter.
Okay, wait a second. It turned out it made no difference in NPR's traffic.
Yeah, but it also made no difference to Twitter.
Okay, but the point
is, whatever you want to call it.
People thought Twitter was absolutely critical to their system. It turned out it wasn't critical at all.
Yeah. I want to ask, in the what do we do thing, here's what I want to ask you. Because one day, in the midst of like the lockdown, so late March 2020, I was walking to work because I was still one of the people going in the building. And I was just thinking that all the weaknesses that we were experiencing during the peak of the pandemic, lack of PPE, the supply chain issues that followed, food supply chain fragility, they all came because, in a sense, we worshiped at the altar of optimization, right? So do you think that it's possible that something like the pandemic, which showed us how fragile these systems actually are, was enough of a wake-up that maybe, we may not see it now, but there could be some sort of motivation to trade a little bit of efficiency and optimization for a whole lot of resilience?
Some de-optimization?
So, yeah, I have two answers to that question. And also, like a good politician, I'd make a terrible question.
And by the way,
for the record,
all of you who have questions, which I know maybe at least there's one, many, you can go ahead and start lining up at the mic. And as soon as Coco's wrapped up, I will open it up to questions.
So the good politician that I'm not, I might shift the answer a different question.
Okay.
Which is that I do think our mindset is changing. I'm pessimistic, though, because I think that the way regulation is, where our focus is in the wrong place. And what I mean by that is that we are focused on the technology, and we're also letting the wolves guard the hen house, or whatever the saying is, right? Is it the foxes or the wolves? I'm not sure. But either way, right, we're letting Google be in charge of AI safety, or, you know, these tech companies, right? Like, that makes no sense at all. And then, you know, on the other hand, we have the government that's either ill-informed or, you know, funded by, or their campaigns are funded by, you know, the very companies that they're supposed to be regulating. And I think the other reason is that, you know, we're focused on the technology rather than, as others have pointed out earlier, right, this massive consolidation of control and power and money by these companies that's gone so unchecked. So I'm optimistic because I think we are waking up to this collectively. I'm pessimistic because it seems like a lot of our efforts to counter it are misdirected, or they're focused on, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, this drive by Silicon Valley largely to de-optimize optimally. So instead of saying, let's step away from Amazon, let's step away from, you know, some of the, you know, or the, this pervasiveness of the of video games and phones and so on and so forth, a lot of the answer that comes from Silicon Valley is, well, like, here's an app so that you can control the amount of time you spend on your phone or on different apps, and you can kind of shut it down when, you know, you've reached a time limit. Well, does that actually solve the problem, or does that continue to reinforce the technologies and really the mindset and the philosophies that they're promulgating?
Yeah. So, but I'll turn to the audience now, but I do wonder if sometimes our well-founded pessimism is a function of perhaps being at the beginning of what could cascade into a much bigger change, and maybe we'd look back and say this was the time where things got rolling, because, you know, there's a couple of cases that the Justice Department has brought against some of these companies for the exact same reasons that you talked about, Coco, so who knows.
Yeah.
Now, I know everybody feels very strongly about this topic, which is why I wanted to do this panel, but I do request that you keep your questions as brief as possible and make sure they're questions so that our panelists have time to answer. Go ahead.
Great. Oh, I'm pretty loud. Okay. Brian, I'm about halfway through Blood and the Machine, and it seems like history almost makes it too easy for you to draw comparisons. It's like spoon-feeding them to you. Between the Luddite Rebellion and the present day, with ruthless entrepreneurs, an uncaring parliament, etc. The difference today that I've found is that big tech isn't just succeeding in regulatory capture, securing legislation on favorable terms, they're also capturing public sentiment. Communities rallied behind the Luddites, but back then the factory owner didn't also own the Washington Post. and so it was very well understood by the community. So my question is, how can we create that same groundswell of common sense, of resistance against exploitative automation, when capitalism and automation are much more closely held in the American, you know, fabric of ideas, even by those it's currently displacing?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's the reason that I was drawn to using this, looking at this historical period as an example to draw a lot of these comparisons and lessons from. The historian David Noble says that the Luddites may have been the last group to really see technology in the present tense. You know, that is, uncoupled from 200 years of ideology that all technology equals progress and it's a good, it's a motor of prosperity and all these things. So they could see specifically, you know, the ways that it was going to deliver a direct harm, or it was going to decrease the amount of money that they could make, it was going to lead to adverse working conditions, and it wasn't a question of whether, like, well, in the long run, maybe this will just lead to a bright, shiny future. It's like, no, this is taking bread off our table now. So it was a much clearer picture. You could also go, hey, I'm not getting as many orders as I did 2 months ago, and, like, there's a factory at the outside town. I wonder where this is going. So you have a direct place to locate your anger, and that sort of was really instrumental in sort of rallying so many people. I would argue that that's starting to happen again right now. I mean, it's not just the big tech companies, but, you know, just you think 10 years ago, there was a halo around all these Silicon Valley companies. Oh, Google's doing no evil, how neat. Like, Amazon, very convenient. And, that has started to erode away. There was the tech lash, precipitated in part by, you know, books like Move Fast, Break Things, and the Cambridge Analytica, but thing after thing after thing. We're at this point where the space is much more malleable and the targets are more obvious. Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, they were heroes 10 years ago. Now they're divisive. But I think the anger is being located in the right areas now, and AI, people feel an awful lot of anxiety around AI. Right. I argued in a column I wrote recently that one reason that the writer's strike was so popular, I mean, who would have thought, right? These are the Hollywood elite writers, like, asking for more money. The public supported them 72% to 19% against the studios. And one reason is everybody feels this anxiety that management is going to use AI to exploit them in one way or another, and they can fight back along those lines. So I think actually 2023 is, as you said, like, I mean, it's great for drawing lessons from my book, because it's just it's almost a one-to-one. These are the new Luddites who are rejecting bad uses of technology in pursuit of a future where we all benefit more from these tools, right, and finding ways to do that. Yeah.
Thank you. Next, please.
I'm grateful for you pointing out some of the inequities that come from technology or progress. I'm disgusted with X. I'm for the Hollywood strike. But I think this forum would have been better off if there were people on the other side. I feel like it's CNN or Fox, where they bring in three or four people. And what I'm particularly focused on is you're saying it's terrifying technology, but there are amazing things going on in AI, in precision medicine, in drug discovery, in materials, either logistics or finding ways where industrial technology, some of these materials are in these countries that you can't get access to because they're run by autocratic nations. The biggest growth in AI is in an area called fairness and bias in the insurance industry, in healthcare, and in lending, where they're trying to create fairness so you're not favoring pricing and access to privileged groups at the expense of minorities. This is one of the biggest areas in AI. I know that because I invest in it.
100%.
And I think it would be good to have people on both sides arguing and discussing this rather than feeling it's one side or the other.
I mean, we're not Luddites. We're all using these devices, right? I mean, we all know that AI is better at reading mammograms than humans are. There's plenty of uses for it. All we're saying is that there are ethical questions that are going to have to be answered in the next 10 years that nobody is spending any time.
That's not true. That's not true. It's just it's blatantly false. There's a huge industry. Governments, the regulators have fined banking institutions billions of dollars, and that's why we're getting fairness and bias in our lending practices, in our healthcare practices, and in our insurance practices.
I'm going to have to just jump in here because I actually do appreciate your point a great deal. I will point out that this is a book festival panel rather than a debate panel. Had it been something different, we probably would have definitely invited people from different points of view. Also, I think it's a tad better than CNN. But but your point, no, your point is very, very well taken. I want to give you one last chance. Do you have a question for the panel or no?
What's your response? I think that response was inadequate.
Okay, well, I'll add that I have to correct John. I'm sorry. So I am a Luddite. But a Luddite is not somebody who hates technology. A Luddite is somebody who aspires to remove the technology that is hurtful to commonality, right? The Luddites were seeking more control over their working lives, over the way that technology impacted their communities. They were, again, technologists themselves. I love technology. I'm a technology columnist. I write about it every day. And the questions I think we're all trying to ask is how do we give people more control, more say, more access to the benefits of technology? How do we ask more frequently, who does technology serve, and is it at the expense of somebody else? Those are just questions we have to ask, I think.
Thank you.
Sorry, I'm feeling like I'm
talking. Hi, so first, I really appreciate all your work and for this discussion today. So my question is for all of you. What advice or suggestions do you have for people who are thinking about changing their relationship to technology to do that in a more humane way and or possibly getting involved in organizing around that?
Coco, you want to take that one?
I wish I'd had a chance to answer the last question. I hesitate. I always get shy when it comes to prescriptions, but even though that's the kind of question I appreciate the most, largely because I don't know. For me personally, I'll just speak to me personally. I have a background in technology. I have a PhD from MIT. I've worked in Silicon Valley. I am still in love with mathematics and statistics and its power. To understand the world in a certain way. And at the same time, I think that we haven't fully acknowledged some of the losses that, you know, just as in any generation that develops a new technology, there are huge benefits and also huge losses. So for me personally, it's been important to, as much as I can, understand how these technologies work so that I can make informed choices about whether I opt in or opt out. And I think that's incredibly hard today because few of us, we're so specialized, our world is so atomized and specialized that few of us can understand, you know, in detail how our computers work, how these algorithms work. But if I have any advice, it would be to encourage people to understand not just how the technologies work, but how the political and economic structures around them work and inform your choices that way.
Are you a tech worker? Sorry, are you? If you're a tech worker, then I'd say get involved in organizing your workplace. There are great resources like Tech Workers Coalition and different places you can plug into. Get some power over how that tech is developed, and that's the best way to do it.
Sorry.
No, that's good.
Thank you all for being here. For people who are interested in applying AI to social problems that we're facing or topics that need attention, like mental health, for example, had you found in writing your book that there are first principles or approaches that would be useful to keep in mind when people are building products with AI for causes that they believe to be shaping the world in a positive way? Or would you just reject even the direction this question is going in and say, no, no matter first principle or approach, building AI is bad and we just shouldn't be engaging in it, even for causes that we want to fix and improve the world with?
Well, I'll just say quickly that the number one thing you can do is to make sure you're in dialogue with the communities that it could affect. So I think the biggest thing that I saw happen with OpenAI, like just unleashing DALL-E and then Midjourney and all this, and all the artists, rightfully so, start freaking out because corporate clients and other things that don't have to publish publicly are already switching over to using these much cheaper tools. And
can I just give you an example?
Yeah.
So DALL-E 3, the new visual thing, came out, and a very famous researcher said, gave it a prompt, show me a picture of a black doctor treating white patients. And it kept showing it a picture of a white doctor treating black patients. And it did it again and again and again. Well, he concluded that there was nothing in the corpus of data that they had bothered to put in of a black doctor treating white patients. He was incapable of doing it. So, I mean, that's the kind of bias that people who are in the tech industry ought to be trying to address all the time.
Yeah, and what I was gonna say is if they had reached out to artist communities, if they had worked in tandem to develop it in ways, like what assurances would you need to make this be a useful tool, you know, how could we get it into your hands? But, or, you know, if there was a dialogue opened up about how it could be used, and I think the same could be true in, you know, the medical community. I mean, all of these industries are worried about displacement and of the job, especially taking, you know, less senior roles and automating them away. That's going to be the chief thing. So figuring out how you're going to navigate that. I think there's a lot of great uses for AI in science. People are using it to find the optimal placement for solar panels and things like that. There's, you know, a lot of cases where it's not going to be the cause of social friction. But if it is, you know, open dialogues, I'd say make sure you try to do that.
So can I just ask really quickly,
were you
coming at that question from the perspective of somebody who works in the field or somebody who works in technology, or both?
I was just recently approached by a group that's trying to start a new AI product for a social cause, mm-hmm. and I come from a background of working on social causes, and I was a bit skeptical about introducing AI, and I was just curious if I could advise a group ethically to do it, and if so, what kind of ethical basis would I use? Because I just don't know if there is one that's why I was asking.
Just remember, it's also part of the hype cycle that both Coco and Brian were talking about earlier. everybody wants to add the word AI to whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
It's a hype cycle.
Yeah.
You're actually in a great position to try to assess, like, well, is it actually going to be useful, or are we going to be paying some company for this service that doesn't actually do anything or maybe makes it worse?
I mean, I also have just another sort of causal prescription. I don't know if it would be useful at all or not, but, you know, people aren't born learning how to program, right? They learn it. It's part of their education. So maybe we ought to have universities that are training folks who will go on to make AI make ethics a requirement of those degrees as well. So, because I don't think this problem's going to be solved overnight, right? Like, the people in place already, we know that many of them, not all, the four that you wrote about in your book, ethics is not on their list of considerations. So maybe it should be wound. I mean, I actually think in medicine is one of the places that you find it now. But anyway, I'm always thinking, like, okay, if we're going to solve this problem for 20 or 30 years from now, what can we do today? But thank you for your question. We have time for one last one, I'm afraid.
There's so much pressure being the last question. Okay. And this is going back to the point you had about art and AI. Would you be okay with AI, using AI to make art, if there was a way for artists to claim their intellectual property and get paid for the art that is being used to train the language learning models?
Yes, I would. I think if there's some kind of compensation mechanism worked out, then I'm fine with that. I'm just against people taking stuff for free and then making money off it.
Yeah, I think that the artist should have, you know, be able to opt into such a system and to start and help and negotiate the terms of any such contract. There is a program like that Adobe has. I think it's called Firefly. And I know artists who have signed up for it and everything. They've never seen a cent. And it's, you know, it also has to be transparent. There have to be mechanisms that make sure that the program's enforced. And, you know, so if it's, it would have to be a case-by-case thing. I know a lot of artists who just would want to opt out and be able to opt out entirely. So it's really up to the artists, I think, who should be. I know people who would want to submit it and say, like, yeah, open source, use my stuff as fodder for the LLMs.
I would ask the question differently. I would say, as an artist, are you okay with using this AI?
Yeah.
Right? Why are we even asked? Like, who cares? Right? It's another technology and it's another business. If it were me, I would think a long time about whether I wanted to do this, both from the perspective of, do I understand this technology? Do I understand my craft, my medium, from first principles? Am I getting better at it, or am I using this technology as a crutch? And also from the perspective that I think art, one of art's functions in society is to challenge these structures. And if you're using these tools uncritically, I think that compromises your ability to use your art to challenge them.
Well, this has been an excellent and vigorous panel. Outside Coco, Brian, and John, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And my last little procedural note is to remind all of you that our three authors will be signing books back there. You just go straight down the aisle and across the hall. You'll see the big piles of books if you're interested. So thank you very much, everyone.
Didn't know about that.
All right. Okay. That's part of the deal.